you keep an eye on them for me and make sure they're not misbehaving while my back's turned. I want to talk to you guys this morning about names. Okay. Have anybody been doing any shopping? Okay. Don't call out. Just raise your hand. Been doing some shopping? Okay. I was thinking about doing some shopping, and there was this store, and it's called Best Buy. And you know what? I thought that's the place I should go. You know why? Why would somebody go to Best Buy? Exactly. Because I want to buy something and it says it's the best place to buy it, right? That is great, great logic. I think they've found their demographic there. Well, and then I saw another store because I was looking for other people. It was named Staples. I wasn't sure if I wanted to go there. What do you think they sell at Staples? School supplies, yes. That's some of the things they sell. Justin? Staples, that's right. So if anyone ever needs to buy staples, there's a whole store just for you. And then there was someone else on my list, and I saw a name of a store, and the name of the store was Kohl's. What do you think they sell at Kohl's? Coal, right. Yeah, so I knew there were some people I need to go shopping there for. They also sell clothes and other things. So there's choices. So each of those names of the stores are trying to tell us something. What about your names? Does anybody know, does your name mean something? Yes. Wisdom. Okay, Sophia is a Greek word for wisdom. Okay, anyone else know if your name means something? Yeah?
My name
It means beautiful. Okay. Well, that's a good one. I don't know anyone whose name means ugly. Okay? So, we just don't have those sort of names. And so when we choose, don't you point. And so when we choose names, when your parents choose names, they choose names that they think are going to be good for you, make you feel good or be good, or they wish good for you. There was a person in the Bible whose name was Simon. And Jesus said to Simon, he said, I'm going to change your name. I'm going to change your name to Peter. He said, because Peter means rock. And that's something solid. And I want you to be solid as you walk around and follow me. Okay, so Jesus said, I want your name to be different. And we see that at different times in the Bible. Abram got changed to Abraham. Sarai got changed to Sarah. And different people change their names for different reasons in the Bible, because the name means something. I don't know if you noticed, but we just sang a song that was about Emmanuel. Anybody know what Emmanuel means? It's a name. And somebody that hasn't had a turn? Anyone? So, all right, yes? It does mean Jesus, and it means, even more specifically, it means God with us. Okay. Did you know the name Jesus means something? What might the name Jesus mean? It means when the angel came to Joseph, the angel said to Joseph, you are to name this baby Jesus. He said, because it means, the name means God saves, and this baby will save his people from their sins. I want to just share one more with you, okay? And that is the name Bethlehem. Did anything interesting ever happen in a place called Bethlehem? You heard of that place before? Yeah, put your hand up if you've heard of Bethlehem before. Okay, so we got pretty much everyone's heard of Bethlehem. Okay, what was it, Mimi? What happened there? Do you remember? You don't want to say? Anyone down that end? Jedrick, come on. No. All right, your mum's going to have words with you afterwards. So in Bethlehem is where Jesus was born. Now the name Bethlehem means, the word Beth means house. Okay? So there's another town called Bethany, means house something. Even today you'll see some Jewish, big Jewish buildings that are called Beth something. It means house maybe of prayer or house of peace. But Bethlehem means house of bread. Now you're thinking of a gingerbread house, aren't you? It's not that kind of bread. It means it was a place where people would perhaps harvest grain, and the farmers would go out and they would get grain, and then they would come back and they would do lots of baking. There was always food there. Always food in Bethany, in Bethlehem. That was a good place to be, a good place to live, and a good place to travel. So, house of bread. Well, here's an interesting thing. Did you know that Jesus was born in a town called the House of Bread? And then later on, Jesus had this to say about himself. He said, "I am the bread of life. Whoever comes to me will never go hungry, and whoever believes in me will never be thirsty." Now, sometimes I'm hungry and sometimes I'm thirsty, but it's not just about eating when Jesus says that. When he says, "I'm the bread of life," did he mean that he was really a gingerbread man from a gingerbread house? Okay, it meant that just like we need food to keep us alive, we need Jesus to keep us healthy. And so Jesus is the bread of life who was born in the house of bread in Bethlehem. Okay. So now you know. I'm glad you're here. And pay attention to names, because sometimes they tell you things. And don't let your parents take you to Coles this Christmas season. All right, thank you. You can go back to your seats. As we approach Christmas over the last few weeks leading up to today, we've looked at the writings from the Old Testament, hundreds of years before Jesus' birth, that pointed to aspects of his birth. And as we do this, we see that Jesus didn't arrive on earth by accident. He didn't arrive on this planet at just a random moment, that Jesus' arrival was something that was planned, something that was expected, and something that people were looking for at the time of his birth. They were looking for a Messiah. Not knowing his name, they simply said, "We're looking for the anointed one, the one that God is going to be with in a special way." And they lived through many silent nights as they waited for the arrival of the Messiah, as they waited for the birth of Jesus. And one way we know that they were looking for a Messiah, which is just one way that we can confirm that Jesus was expected, is from the passage that we just read in Matthew 2. The Magi come to Jerusalem. And I talked about the Magi last year. You can go back and listen to that on the website if you really want to get some more information about them. But the Magi come and they arrive in Jerusalem. They're seeking a newborn king. And they approach the palace in a very logical manner, and they ask for the king of the Jews. This request sent off alarm bells. I don't know if they had any tornado sirens or what the local, you know, fire station alarm system was, but their doorbell, when they rang it, was not that cheerful ding-dong. No, this was something much more attention-getting than that. Herod knew what it meant when somebody asked to see the King of the Jews. That had become, at this time, an alternative title for Messiah. And we see that because he immediately asked the religious scholars where the Messiah would be born. Have a look at that in verse 3. When King Herod heard this, he was disturbed, all Jerusalem with him. And when he called together all the people's chief priests and teachers of the law, he asked them where the Messiah was to be born. He didn't ask, which of my wives has had a child without telling me, or my mistresses, or whoever. He didn't say, which of my sons has been out, you know, messing around. He said, tell me about the Messiah. Because when somebody comes looking for the newborn King of the Jews, then they're looking for a Messiah. And so he gathered the religious scholars of the day, and he said, tell me, what do you know about where this child will be born? Now, before we get into those details, I want us to understand who Herod is. And in this sense, it's a little strange, a little bit of a history lesson, perhaps. But Herod was not the most powerful man in the world. The most powerful man in the world was this guy, Augustus Caesar. He'd defeated Mark Antony. He'd defeated Cleopatra. He had unified the Roman Empire. And he was the undisputed king of the world. But Herod had managed, through political maneuvering, to align himself with Augustus. And that made Herod the most powerful man in the Roman province of Judea. Herod himself was not Jewish. And so when somebody comes looking for King of the Jews, Herod didn't really fit the bill, although he had the title. Herod was actually an Edomite, a historic enemy of the nation of Israel. But he had married into an influential Jewish family and worked his way, maneuvered his way, to become the king of that province. And perhaps because of his background, he continuously sought to prove himself worthy of his throne. One of the ways that Herod did this was through his numerous building projects. He was known as Herod the Great, and he did a great amount of building. His most important, at least for us, building project was the significant renovation of the temple. This is a model that is located in Jerusalem. It's kind of a bit of a guess, but an educated guess of what it would have looked like. It had been the temple, of course, had been destroyed by the Babylonians when they captured Jerusalem. And then if you read the book of Ezra in the Old Testament, we see that it was rebuilt. But even when it was rebuilt, the people wept, because it was nowhere near as glorious. It was a poor imitation of Solomon's temple that had previously existed. And so it stayed that way, though, for several hundred years, from the time of Ezra to the time of Herod. And then Herod builds, or it doesn't rebuild totally, but renovates and beautifies the temple there in Jerusalem. And it was in this temple that Jesus and his apostles visited throughout their lives, renovated by Herod the Great. But Herod didn't build the temple out of religious passion for God, for Yahweh. He also built pagan temples. He built some Roman or Hellenized cities in different parts of the countryside. And when he did that, he put Roman or Greek temples in those cities. So he would just build whatever was going to make people happy. And it was a way of trying to increase
his popularity and his influence. Herod also built palaces and fortresses in different parts of his territory. In fact, even this temple, I don't think it's in that picture, but had a fortress connected to it. So remember the temple guards that came and arrested Jesus in the Garden of Eden? That was because there was a fortress attached to the temple, not in the original plans of God or Solomon. One of his most famous fortresses was, where'd it go? Here, in Masada. It's down in the Judean wilderness. It's on top of a mountain. That mountain is like an oval. You know, it's not connected at that level. It drops down hundreds of feet. And on top of that mountain, he built cisterns to collect rainwater. And as barren as it looks, there was a garrison able to sustain itself there for many, many months. Quite an engineering feat, you know, to build something in a place as desolate as that. He was a great builder. Towards the end of his life, though, Herod became paranoid. He executed at various points three of his own sons on suspicion of conspiracy to overthrow him. Fourth son he pretty much had under house arrest. So he was very quick to extinguish any threats that he perceived, real or imagined, to his throne. So when the Magi knocked on Herod's door, they walked into the most powerful address in the country. And when they asked to meet a new king, they unknowingly provoked Herod's greatest fear. Bethlehem is located just 6 miles from Jerusalem, but it was a world away from heaven, from Herod's palace. Bethlehem is a village. Although the descriptor city of David makes it sound like a grand place, it's a rural farming village. Not many people there. It's agriculture. Certainly no kings. Shepherds minding sheep and goats, farmers growing grain. It really wasn't a place that Herod thought about very much. But God thought about Bethlehem. Roughly 1,000 years earlier, God had rescued a foreign woman named Ruth. She married and settled in Bethlehem. In time, she worked the fields and was part of that agricultural society. But eventually she became the grandmother of King David. And Bethlehem became known as the city of David, his birthplace. So I said Bethlehem wasn't a place that Herod thought of often. That's, I think, the same model of Jerusalem in the days of Jesus. That's Herod's palace up in the top left corner. You can imagine that filled with people bustling to and fro, all carrying out important business. But on this day, Herod thought of Bethlehem. On this day, his scholars reminded him that God's prophets had looked forward to a king other than Herod. And they turned to Micah 5, verses 2 and 4. Bethlehem, though you're small among the clans of Judah. And the first line says, Bethlehem Ephrathah. It just distinguishes the Bethlehem in Judah from a Bethlehem in the northern part of the country. Bethlehem, though you are small among the clans of Judah, out of you will come for me one who will be ruler over Israel, whose origins are from of old, from ancient times. He will stand and shepherd his flock in the strength of the Lord, in the majesty of the name of the Lord his God. And they will live securely, for then his greatness will reach to the ends of the earth. Herod, for all his great buildings, doesn't fit this description. But it's this phrase, though you are small among the clans of Judah, that has caught my attention today. It reminds us of Bethlehem's namesake, David. Because David wasn't always a king. In fact, David wasn't even the most impressive member of his family. When Samuel, God's prophet, came to David's house, pulled up in his chariot and said to David's father, "I'm going to anoint one of your sons king of Israel." David's own father overlooked him. He presented David's 7 older brothers to Samuel, one after the other, while David was left out in the fields minding sheep. Although David was small among his brothers, God transformed David into a mighty warrior and king. And so the prophet Micah is building off this same idea that what David experienced, Bethlehem itself will experience. That Bethlehem, although you are least, you are small amongst the clans of Judah. You will again defy the odds and produce another great ruler, another shepherd, a good shepherd, and his greatness will reach to the ends of the earth. And so we come to the manger. And there in the darkness, away from home, over the hill and out of sight of Herod's palace, there Mary gave birth to a son that she had not expected. There she gave him his first meal as she nursed him. There she wiped him down. There Emmanuel, God with us, took his first breath and cried his first cry. Fully human, fully dependent upon these two people to protect and nurture him. And from that manger grew something beyond all imaginations. Mark mentioned earlier, and as he introduced the Lord's Supper, that no one in that town, no one in those first few chapters of Matthew could have imagined at that point the end of Jesus' life. But then consider, if they couldn't imagine the end of Jesus' life, could they imagine the influence and the impact of Jesus' life that continues today? From that dark night grew Jesus, the Messiah. Herod died just a few years later. Jesus himself died 30 years later. But Jesus, unlike Herod, didn't stay dead. His resurrection breathed new life into his followers, and they spread his good news throughout Jerusalem. But Jerusalem wasn't big enough or grand enough to contain the good news of Jesus, and they traveled throughout Judea and to Samaria, and they filled the countryside with people and with people's ears with stories of Jesus and teachings of God with us. And in time, they traveled across the known world with that message. I read an article this week of a 4th century church building discovered in Ethiopia, down in Africa. It was built around the same time that Constantine made Christianity the official religion of the Roman Empire. And while today we focus on what happened in Rome, the message of the kingdom of God, the good news of Jesus, was just as strong there in the hill country of Ethiopia as it was in the palaces of Rome. And to this day, the message of Christmas and the teaching of Jesus continues to spread around the globe. There are more people who who are followers of Jesus today than there have ever been on the planet at any other time in history. And who could have imagined on that night when those magi rang that doorbell, when Herod said, "Who are you talking about and where should we look?" When Mary and Joseph held that infant and said, "What do we do next?" Who could have imagined what God could do? And I think this principle applies to us as we think about it. I wonder if God doesn't perhaps say about us that though you were the least, though you're the least, I know you try to make yourself the mostest, you know? I know you go through those motions and you try and do that, but I wonder if God doesn't look at us, doesn't come to us and say, though you are the least, though I know the things you mess up, though I know the mistakes, there's something greater ahead of you. You see, Jesus wasn't great because of anything that Mary and Joseph did for him. I mean, they did a lot for him. They were crucial to his upbringing and to his life, and they pointed him to God and set him in that trajectory. But that wasn't what made Jesus great. The apostles weren't great because of their great church leaders, because of their education. The churches in the first centuries were not greater than the pagan temples around them. But God said, though you are least, I can do something with you. The Apostle Paul says this about all of us. For God who said, "Let light shine out of darkness," made his light shine in our hearts to give us the light of the knowledge of God's glory displayed in the face of Christ. But we have this treasure in jars of clay to show that this all-surpassing power is from God and not from us. I don't know about you, but you know, I can look in a mirror and I can say, "Yeah, yeah, I recognize this is a jar of clay. I recognize my limitations, maybe not as many as I should. I recognize my rough patches, my areas for improvement that maybe I still don't see as many as I should." And I can say, "Yes, I acknowledge my jar of clay." But Jesus was clothed. He looked in the mirror, and Jesus also saw a jar of clay because he was God in the flesh. And so I love this description here that we have this treasure in jars of clay, the treasure that is God's glory displayed in the face of Christ, to show that this all-surpassing power is from God and not from us. What can God do through us when we acknowledge our need of Him? And when we look in our mirror, do we see our efforts or do we see God working through us? The birth of Jesus reminds us that because of His love for us, God became human. He left the throne of heaven and He lived in rural Israel. And although His own brothers at times thought He was crazy, He persisted in carrying out God's mission. And when He did that, God blessed His efforts. And so I'm not here to tell you that God will bless all of your efforts, that you will become the greatest, the mostest, fulfill all of your dreams. But I do believe that when we make ourselves available to Him, that God takes who we are and changes the course of our lives in a way that can have a great impact. because that's who God is and what he does. God can do great things through you, through me. He can do great things through this church. And so we can look around and we can say, well, we're not the biggest. We don't have the most resources. I don't know that we can do this or we can do that. But when we make ourselves available to God, then we need to be very careful that we don't put limits on what God can do. Because in this story, it's Herod who tried to put the limits on God. It's Herod who said, that baby, if he was the real king, belongs in this palace. And that baby is, I'm going to make it my business that that baby never becomes a king. But Herod found out that when you go up against God, that while you may succeed for a little time, while you may not notice how bad things are getting, you're not going to succeed ultimately. Now, I don't know if you noticed, but in Matthew's quote of Micah, there's a little change between the text. Micah says, Bethlehem, though you are small among the clans of Judah, out of you will come for me one who will be a ruler over Israel. But when Matthew quotes it, and I don't know if he was just quoting from a different text or if he made this change himself, if he said this text needs to be updated. But Matthew, in chapter 2, verse 6, wrote, but Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, you are by no means least among the rulers of Judah. And so God took what was least and made it the best. In no means the least. And that is the message of Jesus, that we could be down here on earth struggling with the things that we're struggling with, feeling like we have no significance, feeling like we have no purpose, feeling like we have no meaning, and feeling like nobody notices us, nobody pays attention to us, that we don't make a difference. We look back on our life and say, what have I done? We just say, why am I here? And Jesus comes to earth and says, you who thought you were the least, let me come and live among you. And he left the palace far superior to Herod's. He said, let me live among you, so that one day you can live with me. Bethlehem, though you are small among the clans of Judah, out of you will come for me one who will be ruler over Israel, whose origins are from old, from ancient times. He will stand and shepherd his flock in the strength of the Lord, in the majesty of the name of the Lord his God, and they will live securely. For then his greatness will reach to the ends of the earth. And I hope that this Christmas, moving into the coming year, that we can each live securely under the rule of our King, and that we participate extending his greatness to the ends of the earth. And I wonder, what meaning does God have in store for you? How will he use you for his greatness? How will you look back on your life and say, there was a time where I was maybe not the least, but not the greatest, but God came into my life, changed things, and now I'm a child of the King, never to be the least again. If we can encourage you today, if we can support you, if you're having any hardship, please come share it with us. We'll pray with you right now. You can talk to someone afterwards. But let's stand, let's sing, let's rejoice, because Christ is King. God came to earth, dwelt among us, to one day take us to be with him.